Welcome to the Retired Excited Podcast. Retired Excited, the show where we give retired and want to be retired folk a look at how great retired life can be. Here we talk to men and women who are happily retired and loving their life. We explore the techniques, activities, beliefs, and excitement of these happy retirees and examine how every Tom, Dick, and Mary can benefit from their experience. Together, we will delve into what retired happiness really looks like and how anyone can achieve it.
Here is your host, Henry Shapiro.
Hey folks, Henry here at Retired Excited, the show providing inspiration for people who are nearly retired, newly retired, or say they're never going to retire. If you're nearing retirement and fearful of what lies ahead, you don't need to be. If you're already retired and wondering how to fill your days, then this show is exactly for you. Here we talk to retired people doing things that make them happy. Things from stamp collecting to cruising, from dancing to touring the world on a motorbike. There's an exciting stage of life to be enjoyed after full-time work, and it's got nothing to do with your financial situation or social position. We talk to everyday retired people who are living the life they want, and we talk to a few professionals to get expert advice. And I chip in with some of my own experiences. Hi there everybody, Henry here with episode number 36 of Retired Excited. Today we're going to talk about gardening. I'm going to talk about it in a slightly different way to what you are imagining. Our guest, Bob O'Neill, retired early, and at the time he owned an 8-acre block which was an orchard. But his inclination was to gradually develop that into a garden. So that's what he did. Over the following decade, he turned that orchard into an award-winning garden, recognised worldwide. The name was Catandra, and it won the Garden of the Year Award, and it was featured in prestigious books and magazines all around the world. Later, he decided to downsize. He sold that property, and he purchased a home on a one-acre lot in the southeast suburbs of Melbourne. And there he's done it again. He's developed a second brilliant garden of native Australian plants, commencing, I've got to say, when most of us wouldn't even think about it, commenced when he was over 70 years old. He might be the only person who's had two separate gardens to be part of the Open Garden Scheme. In this broad-ranging discussion, we talk about his philosophy on how to plan and develop a garden that suits the plants as well as the gardener. It's a different way of looking at the whole concept, and one that makes perfect sense. The proof is his present garden, which looks mature and lush, and it thrives, although it's only been planted for maybe 4 or 5 years. Bob's particular interest is the Australian native plant called the Kerea, and he's got dozens of variations in his garden, specialising just in that one plant. He finds that endlessly interesting and fascinating. If all this sounds a little bit out of your league, well, we spend a lot of time in the interview discussing how a new gardener can develop a garden, how to select the most appropriate plants to suit the location and the conditions, and the most important piece of advice, don't rush. This really is a fascinating way of looking at gardening, so let's hear from Bob now. Good afternoon, Bob. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Fantastic.
Welcome here.
Thank you. It's a gorgeous day, and I've come to talk to you about gardening. But it's garden. The purpose of this podcast is for retired people, things that people are doing in their retirement. So let me talk to you about retirement just for a second, and then we'll move on into gardening.
Okay.
You're a retired person. That's correct.
I retired early at the age of 53.
And what were you doing before that?
I was teaching. I retired when I was bent and not broken.
Right. I understand.
So I think sometimes people may perhaps continue too long, and they get carried out rather than walk out.
So did you set the date for your retirement yourself?
That stage, the then Premier of Victoria offered some of the older teachers earlier retirement with a handshake, which I've since declared as being tin-foiled, not golden. Enable me to retire at 53, not 55.
So the Premier's said, we'll do this, and who set the actual date for your retirement? Did you do that?
It was set. Those who wished to take the package retired at the 31st of December year.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
So you knew you were going to retire and you're coming up towards retirement. Were you looking forward to it?
To retirement, yes, yes. I think sometimes you enter a workforce with a certain background, both the workforce and yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But as time passes by, you change and also your occupation and its total context, it also changes. So sometimes what your mix was at the beginning is quite different what it would be towards the end.
Are you telling me that you liked teaching but didn't like administration?
I think the changes, I didn't mind administration, I think the changes in the system and the, I suppose, requirements and I suppose the social changes as background totally changed what you were as a teacher and what you did and how you did it. So I felt more comfortable, I suppose, in the what I'd done for years and years, more so than what was kind of coming up to be current. Those entered the workforce as I was leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I entered with the knowing what it was.
Different expectation.
At that point.
Yeah.
What it was 30, 40 years ago.
The Premier made the announcement. You thought, okay, I'm going to go for this. At that point, had you any idea of what you were going to do after you retired?
Basically, we had our 8-acre property, so we would retire with that already paid off.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to get a part-time job next door,
right?
Bottling gas. So we had an income.
Where was the 8 acres?
Wandon North.
Right.
So we had that all set up sort of thing. We also had starting off planting we'd taken out the orchard at that point, and we started putting in gardens to replace the orchard.
So before you retired, is this correct to say, before you retired, you thought, okay, I'm going to develop the property that we own?
Not to that extent, no. It kind of grew and changed.
Yes.
I think it's the way life is sometimes. I mean, some people, I think, can be very structured and organised in what they do and how they do it and their mm-hmm. planning.
Yep.
We were a bit more what kind of grew and developed. We were very flexible in the way we handled it.
I see. So you've got the 8 acres and you start planting it out as a garden. Did you know what you were doing?
Not exactly. It kind of grew. But as it grew, you also, as a person, grew in what you understood and what you could handle. So your skills, your knowledge, I suppose your ideas, your experimentation, all those aspects, all grew with time and your involvement. And what would happen in a situation like that, you get to know different people involved in growing plants as well, making gardens. So you became more involved with meeting and working with other people involved in the same kind of plantings, native plants,
mm-hmm.
where once you might, say, go to a nursery and feel that they had a lot of plants, and indeed they would have, the more you become involved in becoming more specialised in what you would be growing, the more you found the restrictions available or present in the supply of plants at nurseries.
Okay, so I'm just developing this story along a little bit. You've got the 8 acres, you start planting it. 8 acres is a hell of a lot of planting.
Fair bit.
Yes, more than a bit. Tell us how that worked. You couldn't do that all at once, so what happened?
Once you got started, you would probably do about half an acre, a bit more perhaps, year by year, mm-hmm. each year. And you just plant the stuff out. What I'd do, the block of land was more or less sloping, so drainage wasn't a big problem. It's facing north, so you got a fair bit of sun.
Mm-hmm.
The top part was red soil, drained well, which was great for plants. Being open, you had all the sun you would require. So it was quite simple that way. What you do, you either get a hose or you get a number of sticks or rods and you mark out a new garden bed.
Where
the garden bed might be,
yep.
in relation to what you already had, any pathways in between. then you get your good old poison to round up to kill the weeds. You bring a truckload of mulch in and you'd mulch it.
Okay.
Get a new garden bed.
You make it sound very easy, but it sounds
simple.
It's simple, but it's not easy.
Meanwhile, you're propagating your own plants or whichever you can do. And then from the plants you grew or you acquired, especially if I was to buy a new plant, that one of the first jobs would be to take cuttings from it.
I see.
Before you plant it.
Yeah.
And so you might grow half a dozen cuttings or more from the one plant that you buy. So if you pay $10 for a plant, if you get half a dozen plants to grow, it becomes a cheap plant.
Yeah.
I used to make him grow a 6-inch pot plant now for about maybe 60 cents.
Right. Rather than
$11
current
times
for
a 6-inch pot plant. The time lapse of, say, 12 months being a factor.
Yeah.
It also meant if you had half a dozen replicas of exactly the same plant, you could try that one type of plant in several settings.
Yeah.
Be it wet or drier, more sun, less sun, wind or frost, whatever. And from that you determine what conditions that plant did best in.
Let me just carry on a little bit with that particular garden. Now, your garden had a name. What was the name of it?
It was called Catandra Gardens.
Catandra. And it became quite famous.
It's very well known, yes.
Yeah. Now, how did it become famous?
We did have people come to visit. It was in the open garden scheme. I was 2005 Garden of the Year and the open with the ABC Garden of the Year award. And a few visits, which gave us publicity overseas.
Mm.
And having the bed and breakfast and people coming to visit the garden, we had people actually, when they visit Australia, would make our garden part of the destination in Australia if they were garden lovers.
So you went from not really knowing all that much about horticulture.
Not a lot, no.
To having a world-renowned, and you've shown me some photos in some prestigious magazines and a prestigious book internationally. You became internationally known in some period of time. What, 10 years or so?
10, 15 years, just over 10 years. What it means was if you hone in on one particular area and really thoroughly investigate that one area, you can become virtually a world expert in your own backyard, own backyard.
So when you say one area, you mean one particular plant type or?
If you have your own property, your own garden, and you really study your garden, where the frost is, where the frost isn't, which birds or animals are there and not, and you try experimental planting to see what will and won't grow, over time you develop such a close, intimate knowledge of what your own garden is. You are the world expert on your garden. Then nobody can challenge you.
Yes.
Because you have made the study on your own garden. And because we had a larger garden than most, and we experimented with a wide range of plants, we grow stuff from Darwin to Hobart in the one garden.
That's amazing. That range of climate, you're able to still grow those plants.
A bit of a struggle, but if you were to select and plant not to what you wanted, but what the plant needed.
I see.
See, plants require certain conditions. So you basically have to be able to modify or provide the conditions where that particular plant has all its basic requirements within their tolerance range,
right,
whether it be frost, drainage, sun, wind, or shelter, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Now, that make any sense?
It does make sense.
It's very simple. When you think about it, it's quite simple.
You're no longer on that property. We're not sitting on that property in Wandon at the moment.
No.
I'm sitting in your home here in the suburbs on the east side of Melbourne.
Correct.
And you've done it again.
On
a smaller scale. Tell us about the garden.
The garden is 1 acre, but the property 1 acre. But effectively, the garden area would be just over half an acre. So the other garden we have is 8 acres, the property. Under mulch would have been about just over 5 acres. So this garden is about 1/10 of the other garden in actual mulched area. So this is a much smaller proposition than the other one.
But it seems to me that the other one had more mass planting when I looked at the pictures.
Yeah, more mass planting and also had more variation. We had about, say, 40 kinds of wattles. Here we maybe have 3 or 4. We might have had there perhaps about 500-600 couriers,
yep,
plants. Here we might have about just over 200. So the numbers of plants within a particular grouping are diminished, and here there are a lot less larger plants present in the garden. So here there's a lot more focus on smaller plants in this area, more so than the other garden, which can be at times frustrating when you want to put the plants in, but you can't.
Yes.
But that's just part of the deal.
No, I was just going to say to you that, once again, this garden has become part of the open garden scheme, I believe. Is that
it
so?
It has been, yeah. Yes.
And has won a claim as well. So you've done it twice.
It is a garden of interest. What I would like to think is going to happen is people can perhaps use our garden as a way of being inspired, if you like, to have a go themselves. If you go around the suburbs, there are very, very few avenues of you being able to see native gardens of interest, which you have access to. If you walk around any suburb from the front gate, 1 in 100 would have a substantial number of native plants in the front where you can see them.
We didn't say this at the beginning, did we? That this is a
native,
your garden. Interest is native plants.
Correct, yes.
And so all these plants, and listeners, when I asked how many are there, he said, a lot. I don't know. There must be thousands and thousands.
A couple of thousand, I guess. I don't really know.
And they're all native?
Most are. There's also a smaller number of non-natives, especially just around the fringe of the house.
Yep.
When we came here, there were some established beds, plus areas of lawn and also some very large cypress trees. So on arrival, the cypress trees disappeared and most of the lawns have been converted to garden beds.
Yeah.
But we have retained also a small area of non-native plants, which are here initially, most of them, that's fringing around the house.
Listeners, when you look at the website, if you're on the website, not on your phone listening to this, I've got some photos there and you'll see that the garden looks very mature. But how long has it been since you started planting here?
We've been here just less than 6 years. We came with 1,000 plants, and the first winter we lost half of them. So we had to virtually start again. So the oldest plants in the garden would be about 5.5 years. But the majority of the plants would be at least 1 year younger. Simply the others have died. And we've been, a lot of planting has gone on since. So I suppose over half the plants here will be less than 3 years old.
It's astounding, because you wouldn't think so. Looking at, when I look out in the garden, it looks very mature.
It's now established pretty well, yes.
What's the secret? What's the secret to getting them up and jumping out of the ground?
People say I bulldust a bit, and I think bulldust on the hands makes a difference. I think what it is if you can plant plants which... Here, because we had to raise the beds. That's why we had the initial losses. It was too wet. And we couldn't put drains in because it's too flat. So we had to bring in about 140 or so metres of soil to raise the beds. So by putting the plants on the higher beds, especially those which needed the deeper, well-drained soil, they went very well. And, of course, the other little plants which can perhaps handle the wetter conditions, you plant accordingly. So as far as possible, you put the plants in the conditions or areas where it suits their requirements. You don't plant to where you want the plants to go, but you plant them where the plants will do well. It's a blending.
When you say raise the beds, and having looked around the garden, we're not talking about raising a 300 mil, are we? We're talking 100 mil maybe, 4 inches in the old language.
It's about up to 18 inches, I suppose, at some areas.
Okay.
Actually, in fact, it should have been more, but the point is we're operating also on a budget.
Right.
So
the dreaded
we
budget,
should have put the beds even higher than they are.
Yeah.
But money dictated we couldn't afford that. So that has been a bit of a pain in the neck, but that's life.
Now, most of the people who are listening to us are going to be on a normal suburban block. And if they're lucky, they've got, in the old language, a quarter of an acre. But these days, the blocks are tiny.
Mm-hmm.
Can they aspire to doing something like this?
They can't do what we do in the same volume. But I think all they can do is simply put in plans in such a way as to maximise what they do have and plant plants that will suit the conditions that they're exposed to. There's no point in planting a desert plant from Central Australia, which is on the top of a sandhill in full sun. There's no point putting that on a moist, southern, shady area in the suburbs. You're wasting your time and money. The plant just can't grow. So I think the first thing is select plants that will grow in your conditions. And the other point is, I think it's more sense to grow a number of small plants rather than one large one. At least you have a bit of diversity.
Now, most people aren't going to have the knowledge to be able to work all this out. How do they get the knowledge? How do you learn this stuff?
I think if you can have access to visit gardens, it will be on the open garden openings, wherever they might be, native gardens in particular, I suppose, but any garden. I think the principles of gardening will be similar no matter what kind of garden it is. All plants will do best if they have conditions that they prefer to be in.
Can you rely on the information that you get at where you buy the plant, whether it be Bunnings or specialist nurseries?
I think sometimes if you were to go to walk up and down your street or in your area and see what plants are doing well in a garden where the owners or the occupiers are doing a very good job in maintaining their property. Now, I think if you can perhaps approach those people and get some kind of input from them, for what grows in your area similar to your place and is growing well, if you get a bit of background from those people, then maybe that's one very good starting point.
Right.
If I was working at Bunnings, I couldn't advise you, even with my background, I couldn't advise you what you should be growing in your garden because I can't see it. I haven't been there to assess it.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult to give advice if you haven't seen the background and conditions that will operate on those plants.
Now, this is obviously a lot of work, especially in the initial stages when you're building up the beds and so on and so on. And this podcast is for retired people. Is it too much work?
Well, we started this place when I turned at the age of 71, 72. I'm now 77. And we have been able to establish this garden effectively in about 4 to 5 years.
Right.
But the hard work of putting the beds in whatever, all the drains and Yagi pipes and whatever it might be, and taking stuff into white, all that stuff, and getting the plants to grow, then changing things that didn't really suit. You also experiment, and at times you lose plants, and quite a few. And if you put in plants like we do, which are not bulletproof, your chance of losing plants are a little more than bulletproof ones. On the other hand, those plants are more interesting than the bulletproof ones.
Yes.
So I don't really like buying Bunnings specials, which are bulletproof. I think they're boring, and I don't like those.
Right.
So a workload, as I look at it, if you have the interest to keep it up and do it, at least you're inspired to get out of bed in the morning and do something. If you have nothing to do all day except go and watch TV and play a game of cards down the senior sits hall, I think you're more likely to live longer by working in your garden a little more and playing cards a little less.
You've stolen my next question, which was, why do you do this?
It's because I enjoy doing it. A couple of reasons. One, I enjoy the plants themselves and seeing what can be done. I just enjoy the plants. Also, you have a social network you develop of like-minded people, a bit like yourself, where there's no hierarchy that, you know, you're better trained than I am. They accept you as a person, and everyone's different. But they all have the same common character, if you like, of honesty, supportiveness, swap plants, be giving, and not simply trying to extract from you. They're happy to give.
Now, you say that there's a community of people. Where is that community? Is that community in a club? Is it in an association? How do people become involved in that?
Different ways. One, you can go to places like and be a volunteer in a public garden, at the public garden, at the Australian Garden at Cranbourne. I go there once a week to help as a volunteer, propagating plants, with about another 20 people doing much the same kind of thing. And they're some of the best people I know. And some of my best friends would, in fact, be, you develop friendship with those kind of people.
Yes.
Because they're like-minded, with a similar interest to yourself. And they're all different, not all the same. And I find that very satisfying. Also, you can join the Australian Plant Society, APS, and go there to, say, weekly or some monthly meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of those scattered through the suburbs and also different country parties, country areas of Victoria.
Yeah. You've become known in the APS for, well, you've become known in the garden world for a particular plant. Can you talk about that?
I'm fairly well known as being involved with couriers. We have about 11 species of couriers and they're found on the eastern states and just one type and on the eastern side of West Australia. But within each species, you'll find there are many, many variations. So it's like, say, dogs. There may be one breed of dog, but with that one breed of dog, there are many, many variations, perhaps. Smaller, bigger, different shades of colour or whatever, different hair lengths, mm-hmm. whatever. So they're all individual. In a similar way, with couriers, as with other plants, you'll find there's a variation within the species. It could be the size of the flower, its colour, it could be the habit of growth of the plant, it could be the foliage is different.
Is that what makes it fascinating to you, digging out all that variation and that interest?
That's the fascination.
Mm.
And after a while, it's like having a great big jigsaw puzzle.
Oh,
and each little piece of information you learn, for instance, a courier form you might find graded down the Wilson Prom somewhere, that is different perhaps to what you might find up near Mount Dandenong. So you learn that different species in different places, you almost recognise a plant by its appearance. So you wouldn't, for instance, confuse the rosebud form of Reflexa, one grown in the middle of the little desert sort of thing, because they're just different types of plants.
Oh,
perhaps the same species, but the variation is different.
Now, I've just got two more questions, and then we're going to have to finish up. Let's say I've bought a house. You know, just a normal house in the suburbs, and the garden around it is pebbles and exotic plants, and it looks pretty scrappy. How would I go about developing a native garden? What would I do?
The first thing is take out what you don't want. Next, I think, in your own mind, know what type of plant you could put in to take their place. The advice could come from especially the native specialist garden nurseries or from other native gardeners and their gardens. Don't rush into it as far as what you put in. You may have to fashion the beds to be different to what they currently are. You may need to reuse the stones and all those kind of things in a different way to suit your change plans. But I find sometimes the axe is just as useful as the spade.
Correct. Now, having to do with gardening or nothing to do with gardening, someone's about to retire and you're going to give him some sound advice. What would you say to someone who's about to retire?
I think if you were going to retire, if you have the interest in gardening, then pursue it. If you find gardening is a tie, it is a bit of a bondage to you, then stick to a small garden which is easy to maintain. It's like dogs or pets. If you want to travel the world, it's unfair on the dog or the cat to have you travelling back and forth. It's just not fair on the animal. So in a similar way, you can't really have pets if you're going to do a lot of travelling. That they are a hindrance, in which case don't have them. If you're going to do a lot of travelling and you find yourself have other involvements and you're outside your front door more than you are inside your backyard, then keep your garden very simple. But if you prefer to be a stay-at-home person and have your hand in the dirt, and home is your workplace as well as your sleeping and eating place, then that's very different. So really it's a case of you choose activities that suits your preferred lifestyle. And in some cases, that would not be a large garden. In other cases, like for me, it is almost essential.
Something you said then sparked another thought in me. Do you find it therapeutic to be in the garden?
I find it very, very interesting because it's a challenge to see what you can do. So we can grow here now. We have proved we can grow plants in every state in the country, even in just one bed, which probably very few people would have attempted to do. And at the same time, we have kind of developed a lot of friendship with other people with a similar kind of interest. So it's not just an activity, it's also a social life and a set of people who you find you are comfortable with and they are comfortable with you. And maybe some people would rather be with a musical set mm-hmm. or a church set or whatever it might be, or a travelling set of people, friends or acquaintances. In which case, that's the kind of life they had to kind of set up for themselves. But I'm happy and I find very interesting being involved in doing the gardening. It keeps, as far as I'm concerned, it keeps me fit, well, occupied. It gives you, when you travel somewhere, it gives you a basis on which you can view places elsewhere. Associated also with gardens would be the involvement of wildlife, whether birds or animals, which may be present, insects, frogs, and this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just simply growing up plants. And here also we do have a vegetable garden and an orchard as well. So to me, this is a fairly complete place. So we can live here I feel comfortable, shall I say, being able to stay here in, say, 7 days a week, involved with the garden, say, a couple of days a week, time over that period, then you can go beyond your front door with all your other involvements. And perhaps every so often, of course, you can then break up the monotony or the regulation or regularity, where it might be, by taking trips elsewhere, wherever it might be, and for whatever reason. It could be quite different to gardening. It could be footy or anything else.
So the benefits that you've outlined are it's keeping you fit,
yep.
giving you an interest, it's involving you with a community of people who you enjoy and they enjoy your company.
You hope, yes.
Yeah, yes. It's an ever-evolving activity. It's not the same every day. There's lots of benefits.
The other thing is, if I've reached a stage now where in your latter 70s, you realise your life is no longer 50 years ahead of you as well as behind you. So I suppose now, it's in the past I've received a lot. So now I feel there's an obligation, but an opportunity to best pass on ideas, information, inspiration, or of course a lie, to other people at no financial gain to yourself. Not trying to big note, but you feel as if you have an obligation, if you like, to share and give ideas and inspiration to other people coming behind you.
Is that part of the purpose that you talked about earlier on?
I'd say it's part of the purpose. It's just one of the side effects of what you're... And also, I feel I'm perhaps capable of doing that
right.
because of what we've done in the past ourselves. You can't tell people what they should do if they're married, if you've never been married yourself, sort of thing. If you've never been a parent, how can you really... Honestly, you give people advice on parenting. And gardening a bit the same. If you can... If you've been there and done that, to a point, you're able to give some ideas, not advice, but... As I said, when you speak to people, you don't say what they should do or advise you to do this or that, but say, well, I have done this. It's up to you. You take ideas from here, take ideas from there, and a third or fourth, fifth basis. And from all that assortment or background of information and ideas, you select what suits your position best.
Bob, I could go on like this for hours, but we've got to wind up. Can I thank you? Can I thank you for showing me around your amazing garden? It really is amazing. And folks, I am going to put on the website some pictures of the garden and also a book and a couple of books that Bob's Gardens have been featured in. So once again, thank you for all you've done for us today.
Thank you very much.
Well, there you have it. I can imagine that many of you would be a bit freaked out by what you've just heard, but don't worry. Most of us don't have the knowledge or the background to start the process that Bob went into. And here's the thing. He didn't either when he started. When he retired, he wasn't a gardener. He didn't know about horticulture. He learned it as he went along, and he learned it by trial and error, by talking to people and getting some good advice. Now, Bob recommends that if you are interested in developing a similar sort of garden, you join the Australian Native Plants Society. And I've put the link up on the website for you, so you'll be able to find that. It's got branches throughout all the suburbs. He also recommends that people offer to volunteer at one of the public gardens here in Melbourne, or whatever suburb you live in, because you're going to find a community of people there who are knowledgeable and generous with that knowledge, and who will support you and who will help you. Bob tried to meet or walk around his incredible property, and he pointed out the individual plants, but there's a lot more to gardening. He talked about the birds, the lizards, the frogs, and that all adds to the gardening experience. Something I didn't talk about in the interview is that he keeps an amazing record. He records where all the plants are on the property. He records when they flower so that he can look back and he can adjust his gardening so that he has flowers year-round. The garden looks fabulous all year round. And he keeps a record of the birds that he sees. The purpose of that was that he wanted to know if planting extensive native plants would bring additional birds into his garden. So he's got an extensive record of those birds. We've talked about this a few times along the way. Many people are looking for a purpose in life, particularly when they retire and the years are starting to mount up. Well, Bob has an attitude to that. He's amassed a wealth of knowledge about that particular aspect of native gardens, and he considers that it's his purpose to freely give away that knowledge so it's not lost. That's an attitude and a philosophy that could apply to lots of things in life, couldn't it? Develop an expertise or at least some knowledge about something and give it away freely. That could be your purpose. That certainly is Bob's purpose. Hope you've enjoyed this once again. If you have any questions for Bob, he has very generously said to just email me, Henry, henry@retiredexcited.com. I'll immediately pass that message on and he will get back to you. Leave comments in the reply box at the bottom of the page and don't forget to press the share button right at the foot of the page. I hope you've enjoyed this interview. Bob has developed not one but two fascinating gardens. Really, really fabulous gardens. The garden he has presently, which as I said is in the southeast suburbs of Melbourne, you'll be able to have a look at next time there is an open gardens program. So that is it for today. As always, peace, health, happiness. Hope you've enjoyed it, and I'll see you next week. Bye now.
I like that.
I'm going to give that a go for sure.
Ian, that was terrific.
That was interesting. What a good idea.